We're going to take a look at the history of woolen mills. From a woolen mill that's still operating today, how is it that within such a fickle industry and so many woolen mills closing down, how is it one can survive? We'll talk about that and also the history of mills in Australia. Boaz Hirschfeld is from Creswick Woolen Mills and joins us on the program this morning. Hello, Boaz.
Morning, Trevor. How are you going?
Good. Can you tell us, firstly, a bit about the history of your mill?
Sure. Creswick Woolen Mills, which for those that are from interstate, Creswick's located between Daylesford and Ballarat in regional Victoria. It was established in 1947 by my late grandfather, Paul Rizzoli. He was a post-war immigrant and came to Australia along with tens of thousands of other immigrants. Upon arriving in Australia, he made way to government offices to see where he could find a factory to put his future woolen mill.
Had he come from a family that had a history working in milling?
No, he was a relatively young man, but he had a friend that was from his hometown in Poland, and the friend had a long history in working in woolen mills, so he'd been corresponding with him practically around the world, and the friend had already arrived in Melbourne, and Paul came to meet him.
Were there a lack of mills at that time?
There was a history of woolen mills, but what there was in post-war Australia was a lack of building materials. Like we take for granted today, we just go to the local hardware store and pick up what we need. But after Second World War, there was a lack of building materials. So what you needed to find was an existing factory that used to house something else. So he went to the government and they sent him to the decentralisation office. And the decentralisation office found an old straw thatch factory for him that was disused in Creswick, and he would have set out from Melbourne to Creswick in 1947 on some pretty bad and rough and ready roads, and found this old warehouse, old building, and I'm sure in 1947, 1948 they would have told themselves that we'll just do this for a few years and then move back to Melbourne. But once you set up a woolen mill with the size of the machinery and the establishment, you don't really move it.
Where do they actually get the necessary machinery for a wool mill?
So that's once again all the heavy machinery over the years has come from places like Poland and Germany. In the last 10, 20 years, places like Japan and China have begun the heavy machinery manufacturing. But in those days, everything came from Europe. With the factory in hand and a little bit of capital, they found a bank manager, and then they went about importing machines, in this case from England, to start off with.
Then once they've established that they're going to do the milling, is there plenty of people around that area to be able to provide the wool? How did people get the wool to the mill?
Well, I guess it's the other fascinating feature that in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, we had an abundance of wool. The story goes that Australia lived off the sheep's back, so to speak. So for all the 1800s and the early 1900s, we were growing our wool clip at an amazing rate, and we were sending lots of clip to Europe, to different countries. When the Second World War came along, we weren't allowed to ship wool to Germany anymore for obvious reasons, and England basically took the whole clip. So back then, there was definitely a local processing industry, but a huge proportion of the wool clip went to England, really, for the decade, for the years before the war and the decades after. The other side of your question is where did we get the people from? Because obviously woolen mills and trained people, and really interesting, around the mill there's probably 10, 15 houses around the mill that my grandfather built, because he needed to build housing for the people that lived in Melbourne or other parts in Australia. And a lot of them were also recent immigrants to Australia that had come here and had experience in that sort of work in Europe, and they needed housing, so he didn't just have to build a woolen mill, he had to build housing as well.
So it's almost like a mining company.
I guess it's 1940s and 1950s, if you think about it, some of the largest companies in Australia listed on the stock exchange were textile companies, and we weren't a listed company, we were always a family company. But it's probably the boom times of the day, and it's probably what grew Australia, and that sort of textile manufacturing grew to be probably the largest employer in Australia in those decades.
Good morning, Glad.
I've just woken up and heard you speak about woolen mills. I used to live in Geelong, and I was involved in oral history, and one of my favourite stories was about the RSL mill in Geelong, down on the Barwon River. And now we've got the Wool Museum in Geelong. Of course, many people visit that. But I just feel so fortunate to be able to speak to some of the people that were involved with the mill when it began. And it began after the First World War and set up by the 200 diggers that met and supported the mill.
How long did it go for, Glad? How long did that mill go for in Geelong?
Look, I can't say when it finished, but the building's still there, and it's used.
It's used as a museum.
But I often think when people go to Geelong, you know where the roundabout is. Mm. You would know it, just near the town hall. When you're walking towards the town hall, there's a tiny, tiny little statue on the ground. It's quite small, but it's a statue called the Spirit of Anzac. I often think people must wonder, you know, where it's from. Well, that used to sit at the woolen mill, at the entrance. It was set into the building, and then they took it off and put it there. But I do want to say that the stories that I had were people that were there, that worked in the mill all their lives, because they, Chilwell, the suburb of Chilwell, just about everybody that lived in that suburb worked at the mill. And the people that I spoke to was Jack Callender, that worked with one of the managers there for years. He started off, you know, as a young boy, and the other one was Jim Lynch.
Glad, thank you. I just want to go back to Boaz, because Geelong, another one in Victoria, both of those wool mills would have been quite recognised and know each other, Boaz.
Sure, and obviously Geelong was one of the central points of Australian wool processing as well, with scours. And you've got to remember, just similarly to the car industry, as we discussed now, that in textile processing there were so many stages. There were so many stages from the wool collection and the wool brokers to the process of cleaning the wool, then to the pre-process. And obviously on the other side of a woolen mill makes spun yarn. You then had weaving sheds and finishing sheds, and then you had, depending on the product, a whole range of people that are then working with the yarn or working with the fabric. You've got knitters, and you've got people cut sew and make. So, you know, around Geelong there would have been such a broad industry around the woolen mill, both, you know, feeding it with wool and utilising the products that it's making. So I guess that's the fascinating part, that the romantic history of wool and romantic history of woolen mill is, you know, surrounded by a whole range of businesses and companies that then feed off it.
But it's the wool industry, as far as the production, is a huge one, because it goes wheat sheep farms in Western Australia, Victoria, New South Wales, South Australia. So were there similar mills, or it set up around all states?
Absolutely. Like in those days, 40s, 50s, 60s, there was a woolen mill in every small town. Like Victoria had a larger concentration from Warrnambool to Geelong to Ballarat to the suburbs around Melbourne. But places like Albany in Western Australia, places like Ongaparinga, the Ongaparinga River in South Australia, places like Orange in New South Wales, you know, they all had their woolen mill. And in those days, economies of scale wasn't the most important thing. The most important thing was access to the wool and a historical use of capital. So similar to the returned soldiers in Geelong, there were places all around Australia where someone at one point, either government or private, decided to create employment for people by spending the money on the original capital, and then obviously with the access to wool, the return and the ability to maintain those machines for those decades was very possible.
And was it mainly migrant workers that were working on the mills?
Well, it's another interesting question, isn't it, of Aussies and migrants, because I guess over the decades it's always been a mix of people that are recently arrived in Australia and people whose parents recently arrived in Australia and people whose grandparents recently arrived. But in the hard work environment, I think you'd find that there was always room for a migrant that had previous experience in textiles overseas.
It's interesting as you're talking, because Australia was well recognised for its natural produce and for primary produce and sending it overseas and it coming back, and the manufacturing and how it hasn't survived. But here we see that in some ways milling has survived and what's happening in wool production. How has it changed over the years to make it so that it can still survive?
Well, in simple terms, if you want to make anything in Australia, you've got to have a reason and a purpose. It's now 20, 30, 40 years since government policy changed and tariffs came down. And for those of your listeners to imagine, it was basically 30 or 40% more expensive to import products when we had tariffs. So as soon as tariffs came down, places like China, India, the products then became much, much cheaper. So as a consequence, the demand for the local woolen mills and all those other textile firms we were talking about before, the demand started to drop. So to stay in business, what you had to do was not make products where the raw material was, low grade, and basically a higher micron. And micron is the diameter of the fibre. So the higher the micron is, the coarser or the rougher the product. But what a company had to do was make better and better products. And if you can imagine the cost of a raw material, and some of our products have a cost of raw material of $30 or $40 compared to $3 or $4, if you're using a higher cost of raw material, well, the Chinese and your Indian competitors have to pay the same money for raw material. So you become more competitive and you become more and more famous for a specific product. Mm-hmm. The volume might not be there, but the value is there, and what Australian consumers, they love is good, high quality products with an Australian heritage, and as an Australian manufacturer, you can't rest on your laurels. You have to find products that people actually want, and consequently, over the years, more and more Australian manufacturers found that very, very difficult.
We'll come back to that, actually. Let's go back again and talk about what the mill used to produce when it first opened.
So back in the 1940s, 1950s, there was a queue at the woolen mill's door. The woolen mills of Australia, they couldn't make enough. Australia didn't really have an import culture. It didn't really have huge amounts of imports coming in. So my grandfather would go to Flinders Lane, which is another sentimental part of Melbourne and Australia's history, and they would demand off him fabrics for dresses, fabrics for skirts, fabrics for sports coats. So you're thinking of really beautiful old tweeds and beautiful old checks, things that we consider today old-fashioned. Back then was high fashion and well in demand. So these beautiful old fabrics were checks and houndstooths, and your listeners would remember all these beautiful old names that these fabrics had.
So you were producing just basic woolen, well, not basic woolen cloth, but good quality woolen cloth, and your grandfather was then going down and just selling it himself down in the cities.
That's right, and there'd be different agents and different wholesalers, but basically the rolls of the Creswick Woolen Mills made rolls of fabric. And the other fascinating thing about the Creswick Woolen Mills and places like the Warrnambool Woolen Mills, with the lack, we had lots of wool in those years, but there were lacks of things like dye stuffs to colour the wools. And one of the ways that woolen mills got around that, they recycled old jumpers. Now, this is really a fascinating fact, but what European mills did in the years of austerity, in the years of shortage, they would basically, in simple terms, you'd take 1,000 black jumpers, you'd take the zipper, you'd take the label off, and you'd put it through a rag tearing machine, and you'd effectively recycle those black jumpers into what it was, 1,000 kilos of black wool. You'd then spin those black jumpers and you'd blend it with wool and you'd end up with what they called shoddy or recycled wool. It's another fascinating aspect of Australia's history where the early recyclers were in actual fact woolen mills.
I thought you were going to say that they did the same thing as what happens with me when I put a dark blue jumper in with the sheets, and they all come out blue.
Yeah, well, that's a similar policy, similar thought. So yeah, that sort of practice went out 20, 30 years ago, as labour once again became very difficult because that's obviously a very labour-intensive process of recycling those garments. But your beautiful fabrics of the day did have those sort of recycled fibres in there.
When you then go through the 50s and 60s, how was the industry changing through that time?
Well, as you go through the 50s and 60s, you're making fabrics for dressing gowns, you're making fabrics for bluey jackets, you're making fabrics, and this will make some of your listeners smile, for traditional old woolen electric blankets. So brand names of yesterday like Caressa and Linda and lots of other brand names people remember under their sheets. They had this ugly purple or ugly brown check electric blanket, especially you still go to some country motels today and they're still hiding under the sheets. Well, they're the fabrics that Creswick Woolen Mills used to make for all those 50s and 60s and 70s. So
these mills are responsible for those dressing gowns that I used to itch myself in every single night going to bed when I was about 7 or 8 years old.
Exactly right, and Mum or Nan, would have wrapped you up so tight in those cold nights because the heating probably wasn't as good as it is now, and those electric dressing gowns would have kept you lovely and snug.
Every single kid in the 60s and 70s, every single kid had one of those dressing gowns.
Absolutely, and that's the other thing. It's not just imports that have changed the Australian textiles. It's also fashion and taste. And heating for that matter. There was something called a billabong rug or a buggy rug. You know, once upon a time, cars didn't have such good heating. And in the back of every car was another one of those itchy, car rugs or picnic rugs. And these days we don't need rugs or blankets in the back of the car. And I probably haven't met for a long time a kid that would put on a woolen dressing gown. So, tastes have changed a lot as well.
Boaz, at this time, were you having to compete at all with overseas markets?
Absolutely.
Back in the beginning?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, I guess the tariffs were still very, very high. But once you get to the late 70s and the 80s, you've got famous people like Senator Buttons removing tariffs and telling everyone if you can't stand the heat in the kitchen, get out of the kitchen. So by the time you get to 1980s, you start reading in the newspapers about colossal job losses and factories closing down. And at the end of the day, the people in Canberra that look forward, what they see is huge mills in China and India of huge, huge scale. And effectively, there's no way that the metaphor we were using before, Australian factories can process large volumes with low-cost raw material. And the reason is the wage difference between those countries and Australia are so massive that if you're trying to produce things with low-cost raw materials, then you're basically going to be too expensive. So what happens is the manufacturing industry starts to value-add and make a more improved product, but that requires less volume and therefore less jobs. So you start to see a change very, very quickly as tariffs change in the 1980s, 1990s. And, you talk about Creswick Woolen Mills, there's reasons why Creswick Woolen Mills is still there, and that can't apply to every factory. So
We're based in regional Australia, so the land values are totally different in a place like Creswick to a place like Carlton, which had, you know, mills that were probably the first to go just because of land prices. Creswick Woolen Mills was always a privately owned company, whereas a lot of the woolen mills were part of public companies. And as soon as a public company doesn't make enough money, you know, divisions are closed down straight away. Whereas if you're a private company, you know, the family can choose, or the owners can choose to keep the place going. And the third reason is my late grandfather, he passed away at the age of 96. The mill for him was a hobby and a passion, and there was never any way he was going to close the mill down. And, you know, not all manufacturing have a man of such vision and such long-term tenacity. So, you know, in circumstances where generations don't want to run a mill, or the original founder isn't there, then that's another reason places have closed. So lots of reasons for mills closing, and I guess they're the three main reasons that Creswick Woolen Mill still stands.
Yes, but you're still involved in the industry, and I presume you're not there for a hobby.
No, I'm there every day fighting a good fight. And what your listeners, I know, appreciate, because we all have buy local. So, you know, we've got buy local in our little towns, we've got buy local in our state, and we've got buy local as buy Australia. What we all understand is our buying choices really do keep jobs, and our buying choices really do affect the ability for companies to operate. And it's a huge effect that Australian consumers have if they do want to buy local.
Just on that, because I've got a text here that says, "And I live near Creswick, but she said that she was sad to find under the mill label was made in China on some garments."
Yes, and that's really fascinating as well, because one of the reasons that a lot of mills closed is they refused to import alongside their products. So if you can imagine this poor little company down the road, and he's working so hard and he's making products, and just up the road there's an importer that imports all the products and basically knocks out the local manufacturer. Well, that idea, that happened all across Australia for the last 20, 30, 40 years. At Creswick Woolen Mills, we're really proud to make alpaca blankets, and we're really proud to make personal protection blankets for CFA and RFS, and that's what we're good at. But as a brand, our brand talks about natural fibres, and there's a whole range of products that can't be made in Australia that have to be made overseas. But our friendly and lovely consumers, they love those products. So if it's a lovely possum or cashmere jumper, those products can't be made in Australia, but they fit really well under a natural fibre product. So Creswick Woolen Mills today has a mix of locally made products and high quality imports.
And it's and the important thing there is that you clearly label what is and what isn't.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when you think about it, labelling is so important to a company like Creswick, because we're the last manufacturer of so many products. If it's like socks or scarves or lovely throw rugs or blankets. So labelling is so important to a company like Creswick, because we want to proudly label what we make. And then, of course, we want to label what we don't make for the consumer. And we do get people coming in our natural fibre shops and saying, oh, why is this product made in China? Or why is this product made in New Zealand? Or why is this product made in Peru? Or why is this product made in Lithuania? We've actually got the United Nations of natural fibre products there. And sometimes people are disappointed, but there's two realities. First of all, a lot of products aren't made in Australia anymore. And the other reality is that if more manufacturers complemented their products with imported products over the years, there'd probably be more manufacturers in Australia today.
David, good morning.
Good morning. I was just listening to you and your guest talking about selling textile industry, and I was involved with a group that that operated Yarra Falls for many, many years in Abbotsford, and it wasn't until my involvement that I really understood that just how many processes were involved in creating some woolen fabric, and this involved from the manufacturing of the wool top. And at one stage, back when in 1913, when Yarra Falls was originally built.
How long did it last for, David? When did it close?
Yarra Falls closed down in Abbotsford. The building is still there. I mean, there was an old building there down in Johnson Street that probably would have been in the 1990.
Yeah.
1995. But it operated, it was a building that was constructed, it was a massive building that Yarra Falls operated, and later years Country Road operated in the same building, and it employed something like 1,300 people when it was originally built.
David, that's such a good point about employment. And as you were saying earlier, Boaz, you were mentioning the 80s and 90s. I've got a couple of texts here. In Orange, there was a woolen mill that shut down in the 80s. There was a large exporter and processor called Macquarie Worsted that closed in the 90s. Another one saying, I can remember seeing the wool sheds in Sydney in the area and burning down in the 90s. And he says there, I reckon it because they wanted the real estate. It seems like the 80s and the 90s was the era when we started, because you were saying, because of tariffs, that we started to see them closing down.
Absolutely. And it's like gravity. Once one part of the supply chain closes, and it makes it hard for the other side of the supply chain. And it's exactly the conversation and the debate we're having in the car industry now is exactly the conversation they had in the textile industry 20, 30 years ago.
Hello, Valerie.
At the moment, I'm sitting up in bed in Melbourne. Hobart, I come from Melbourne. And I've got blankets that were my grandmother's. And I've got the label here on one of the blankets. And it says Myrall, M-Y-R-A-L-L, Hygienic Odorless. The Meyer Guarantee blankets. They're odourless. The Meyer Emporium Limited Melbourne awards the certificate of the Royal Institute of Public Health and Hygiene London.
You know, those blankets, Boaz, I don't know if you've still got blankets that your grandmother made, but woolen blankets last forever.
Absolutely. And I guess we're proud in our family we've got blankets that we make. So it's one of those unique quirks of history. But when you travel around motels or when you visit relatives that have, you know, had the houses for generations, it's amazing how products that used to be made, and I think we hear this from our older relatives all the time, things were made right and things were made to last forever. Mm. When you think of today's big box retailers, it's basically they sell landfill. Because a lot of the things you buy these days are designed to last 1 or 2 years and then off they go to the tip.
I've always wondered this, whether or not the wool industry and blanket industry got badly affected when doonas became popular.
Yes, definitely. That was another change of fashion when that happened. And when you visit places in Asia or visit places in North America, they really never had blankets at all because doonas or duvets were part of fashion now for hundreds of years. So it's an interesting quirk of fate that our love of wool and our development of a woolen mill and woolen textile industry meant that blankets were such a part of our history and our heritage.
Bob's there. He worked in the industry. Hello, Bob.
Yeah, how are you going?
What was it like?
In the UK when I started, it was pretty good. When I came out here working for Baker Textiles, the political scene was a case of dropping tariffs, etc., and I saw the writing there on the wall for me in the industry, so I got out of it in the early 70s. But Beckart Textiles are still in existence in Dandenong, but we used to make mostly mattress ticking.
Mm-hmm. And what was your job?
I started off as a weaver and finished up as a loom tuner and got into the jacquard mechanical side of it as well.
Boaz, do those jobs still exist?
Well, all those jobs still exist, but where there would have been, 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 weavers in Australia once upon a time, today we probably have 100 weavers or 50 weavers. So the jobs exist, but the other interesting aspect is if in a shrinking industry, you stop training people. So if kids aren't being trained or, if people aren't entering the industry, then there's a skill shortage. And then suddenly when a manufacturer needs a particular skill, he can't get it. So then the manufacturer doesn't, complete that next step of investment. And it's a vicious cycle altogether. So
given the state of manufacturing at the moment, how do you convince people to be involved in the industry?
Well, the truth is that the industry is populated, or the workers in the industry have been in it for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. There's not that many young people that come into an industry like that. But if you put your traditional woolen mills aside for a moment, the amazing thing about Australia is innovation. And the Australian textile industry today is full of innovative companies. They're still making textiles. It's just totally different to the textiles of the past. There could be a really efficient way of making a non-woven fabric, or it could be, you know, the nice lady before in Tasmania was talking about odourless. It could be a way of making new age odourless products that, you know, that the world hasn't seen before. So there still is a flourishing textile industry, albeit smaller. But what the people are forced to do, and we were talking about it before, if you're going to make something in Australia, you've got to have a reason to do it. And there's quite innovative people out there that have found ways to make unique and different textiles. So, you know, we've got a lot of nostalgia this morning talking about the woolen mills and textiles of the past, but there's some really amazing companies out there finding ways to do it into the future.
Boaz, we've got 10 seconds. Is Cresic going to be around for the next 65 years?
Definitely will be, and with support of Australia and Australian consumers, it definitely makes for a possible future.
Good on you. Thank you for joining us on the program.
Thanks for your time.